in 2021, I wrote a feature for the New York Times about what I thought would be the death of gay restaurants.
Author Eric Piepenberg.
I was so wrong. I love gay restaurants. I remember gay restaurants. I still go to gay restaurants. So I think for my first book, I'm going to write a book about gay restaurants, which is, as far as I know, still no one's ever written. To me, a gay restaurant is a restaurant where when I open the door, I look around and I see my people.
Happy Pride, and welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Dozens of Europarliament members plan to defy the Budapest Pride ban. UK trans women can now be strip searched by male cops. And a unique history of queer people meeting and eating. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Marcos Najera.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 31st, 2025. More than 70 members of the European Parliament plan to defy a ban on Budapest Pride. They're heeding the call of Pride organizers for international allies, activists, and friends to support their standoff against Hungary's autocratic Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, according to CNN. Orbán's compliant parliament approved his constitutional amendment earlier this year, outlawing all LGBTQ pride events, ostensibly in the name of child protection. Budapest police say they'll use facial recognition software to identify and fine everyone who attends the June 28th parade. 20 of Hungary's fellow European Union member nations condemned the anti-queer legislation in a letter this week. Foreign ministries including Austria, Belgium, the Czech Republic, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden said the European Commission should expeditiously make full use of the rule of law toolbox at its disposal if the Pride ban is not lifted. The letter reads in part, "Respecting and protecting the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all people, including LGBTIQ plus persons, is inherent in being part of the European family. This is our responsibility and shared commitment of the member states and the European institutions." Orbán has been at odds with the EU for years now. He's turned his nose up at significant EU funding that's been withheld because of the Eastern European countries' escalating anti-democratic, anti-queer, and racist anti-immigrant laws.
Transgender women suspects in the UK can now be strip-searched by male cops. The National Police Chiefs Council issued its interim guidance to every police force on May 22nd in keeping with the Supreme Court ruling that trans women are not legal women under the 2010 Equality Act. The NPCC guidance says the ruling makes clear that thorough police searches, such as those which expose intimate body parts, should be carried out by police officers and staff of the same biological sex as the detained person. The guidelines extend to transgender officers and prison staff. Very limited exceptions may be allowed if someone asks to be searched by a police officer in their affirmed gender. The guidance demands that any search not conducted in line with biological sex must have the written consent of the detainee, the officer carrying out the search, as well as the authorizing officer. NPCC Chair Chief Constable Gavin Stevens posted on the group's website, "We understand the depth of feeling there is on these issues, both among transgender communities as well as those who hold gender-critical views. Policing remains committed to treating everyone with fairness, dignity, and respect." The April 16th UK High Court ruling was the result of a case filed by the gender-critical group For Women Scotland. They sued the Scottish government for a policy declaration that trans women were considered women on government boards that require equal male-female membership. angry protests over the continued degradation of transgender rights have erupted in Edinburgh and London, according to qnews.com.au. One group of trans women stood topless outside the Scottish Parliament following its decision to weave the Supreme Court's ruling into federal policy. Lawmakers decided that the use of all sex-specific facilities in the building must now be based on a person's birth gender. Hundreds of protesters marched from Marby Arch to Downing Street in London, organized by the activist group Strive, standing for trans rights, inclusion, and visibility everywhere. Demonstrators were invited to remove their tops, and several waved trans flags defiantly bare-chested at the gates of Number 10.
The asylum case of gay Venezuelan makeup artist Andre Hernandez Romero has been dismissed by an immigration judge in San Diego, California. As far as his attorneys know, he's languishing in El Salvador's infamous maximum security CICAT prison, remanded there in March without warning by the Trump administration. They have not been able to confirm his whereabouts, communicate with him, or determine his current physical and mental condition. Hernandez Romero's asylum claim was based on the persecution he endured for being queer and expressing progressive political beliefs in Venezuela. He had complied with all aspects of the process and was waiting for his hearing at San Diego's Otay Mesa Detention Center, according to the Immigration Defenders Law Center. He's now the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit filed in March by the American Civil Liberties Union, Democracy Ford, and the ACLU of D.C., demanding the return of all the men shipped off to CICAT without due process. Close to 200 Venezuelans have gone to CICAT in the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign against what the president has called terrorists. Like others, Hernandez Romero has tattoos that supposedly prove his membership in the notorious Tren de Aragua gang. His lawyers say that the gay man's tattoos represent nothing of the sort. U.S. immigration judges work for the Department of Justice and are not part of the independent federal judiciary. Hernandez Romero supporters worry that a Justice Department politicized under Trump will never give him a fair hearing. The dismissal of his asylum case robs Hernandez Romero of a key link to the U.S. system of due process. This week's ruling means he can apply again, but only if he returns to the U.S., according to NBC News. Of course, that's impossible under the circumstances. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has rebuffed requests for intervention from openly gay U.S. Congressman from California, Robert Garcia, and other sympathetic lawmakers.
In better queer immigration news, a district judge is ordering that a gay Guatemalan man be returned to the U.S. The man, identified only by the initials OCG, was seeking asylum because of the anti-queer violence he had suffered at home. He was presumably protected under an immigration order issued last year, but the Trump administration suddenly sent OCG to Mexico, where he had been raped and held for ransom on his journey to the U.S. He was returned to Guatemala 2 months ago. Since then, he said in a declaration to the court, "I have been living in hiding, in constant panic and constant fear." U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy said the deportation lacked any semblance of due process. In Murphy's words, "No one has ever suggested that OCG poses any sort of security threat. In general, this case presents no special facts or legal circumstances, only the banal horror of a man being wrongfully loaded onto a bus and sent back to a country where he was allegedly just raped and kidnapped. Whether the Trump administration obeys the ruling remains to be seen."
Finally, for an anti-woke schedule that's supposed to be free of drag, the 2025-2026 season at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts will still feature plenty of men in dresses. President Donald Trump's all-caps rant on his Feeble Truth social platform screamed, "No more drag shows or other anti-American propaganda," when he announced in February that he had fired the board and installed himself as chair. Gay sycophant Rick Grinnell was named as the head of the nation's Washington, D.C. showplace. Trump declared, "Just last year, the Kennedy Center featured drag shows specifically targeting our youth. This will stop. Maybe it escaped the reality TV star's notice, or maybe it's just a classic Trumpian reversal of policy, but here's a taste of the upcoming Kennedy Center season.
Guys, I need you to make me a woman.
What?
Miranda is hiring a nanny, and I put myself up for the job as a woman, and I have an interview tomorrow.
What?
Guys, please, I'm begging you. Make me a woman. Give it a shot. Come on and give me the best that you've got.
The hit Broadway musical, Mrs. Doubtfire, tells the story of a father posing as a female nanny to spend more time with his children after a divorce. That's not all. The Kennedy Center will also host Monty Python's Spamalot, with men dressed as women in prominent scenes. Moulin Rouge will be performed, including a drag queen character named Baby Doll. Someone will take the role of Chicago's Mama Morton, made famous by queer icon Queen Latifah and drag queen Jinx Monsoon. Chicago character Mary Sunshine is revealed to be male in one of the show's most memorable scenes. So, maybe just a few more drag shows, Mr. President.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending May 31st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Are you what you eat? What, where, and with whom to eat have been defining traits of the community as queer people have found love, friendship, and fellowship, be it over patty melts, pizza, or lobster thermidor. That rich history is served up by Eric Piepenberg in his new book, Dining Out. This Way Out's David Hunt lays out a feast from Piepenberg's culinary journey to show how tastes and taste buds have changed.
No portrait of America's culinary history or queer past is complete without memories of LGBTQ+ restaurants, where moments, big and small, helped shape individuals and communities. So writes journalist Eric Piepenberg in his first book, titled Dining Out, First Dates, Defiant Nights, and Last Call Disco Fries at America's Gay Restaurants, published by Grand Central Publishing. It's a history book, a travelogue, a coming-out story, but most of all, a good read about the mostly good food served up to generations of hungry queer folk across the United States. How did dining influence gay lifestyles of yesteryear? What's the state of queer dining today? And what makes a gay restaurant gay, anyway? Those questions and more are on the menu as I sit down to chew the fat with author Eric Piepenberg. In Armistead Maupin's 1978 novel, Tales of the City, Cleveland, Ohio transplant Marianne Singleton arrives in San Francisco eager to immerse herself in the vibrant and decidedly alternative culture of one of America's gay capital cities. "I'm starved," she announces, speaking no doubt for many a wide-eyed refugee from the heartland, gay and straight. I'm David Hunt. Eric Piepenberg followed that trajectory a decade later, leaving his Rust Belt hometown to live, work, and love in some of the nation's great gay metros, New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. If he was starving for a taste of gay life, he would find it, in his words, in all kinds of restaurants, from cozy family-run taquerias and working-class pubs to tiny dive bars and James Beard award-winning bistros. Piepenberg worried for a time that he was witnessing the end of an era.
In 2021, I wrote a feature for the New York Times about what I thought would be the death of gay restaurants. I came out and came of age as a gay man in the 90s. I lived in Chicago, in D.C., in New York, and on a Friday night in D.C., for example, on 17th Street, you could just go from gay restaurant to gay restaurant to gay restaurant to gay restaurant. And that's the same in many other gay neighborhoods across the country. But I hadn't seen that much in New York, where I live now. And I thought, well, gay restaurants aren't a thing anymore. I was so wrong. After I started talking to people and did some reporting on the piece, I realized that gay restaurants are not what they were in New York, but in other parts of the country, they are absolutely thriving. So I had so much material left over from this New York Times feature that I thought, well, you know what? I love gay restaurants. I remember gay restaurants. I still go to gay restaurants. So I think for my first book, I'm going to write a book about gay restaurants, which is, as far as I know, still no one's ever written. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to be the guy to write that book.
Piepenberg's journalistic journey became a literary journey, a journey that wound its way across the United States and across generations. To read Dining Out is to join Piepenberg on a trek that takes you from Walt Whitman's weekly lunches with his bohemian pals at Pfaff's Saloon in New York in the mid-19th century, to drag brunch at Hamburger Mary's in disco-era San Francisco, where regulars included then-Mayor Dianne Feinstein, from Annie's Paramount Steakhouse in Washington, D.C., arguably the oldest gay restaurant in the nation, renowned for its hefty steaks and strong cocktails, to Bloodroot in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a feminist salon and bookstore with no cash registers, no wait staff, and a seasonal vegetarian menu. The book includes chapters on trend-setting restaurants like Lucky Chang's in New York City, cruisy clubs like Gallus in Atlanta, and trans-friendly eateries like the Napolese Lounge and Grill in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Dining Out explores the role of gay restaurants in the fight for queer equality and in the response to the AIDS epidemic. And the book takes a fresh look at queer resistance in the pre-Stonewall era, at places like Cooper's Donuts in Los Angeles and Compton's Cafeteria in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. I asked Piepenberg how he researched the rich history of gay dining, from automats to bathhouse barbecues, greasy spoons to Michelin star hotspots.
I went to archives across the country and cities that I visited and just sort of like looked around at the gay press, if there was a gay newspaper, because usually what you'd find are ads. Newspapers from the 70s and 80s, certainly, that would be filled with ads from gay restaurants saying, come to our buffet or our brunch, what have you. But for earlier places like the automat in the 30s, there's a lot of information out there about automats generally. But it makes sense when I sort of dug a little deeper into the automats that, yeah, it was open to everyone. You could come in. If you had a dime, you'd put a dime in the slot, you get a piece of pie and a cup of coffee for 5 cents, and you could sit there. And if one thing, I'll speak for gay men, they're good at is sort of scoping out the right place to be to find each other. And I think the automat is an early example of the kind of place that was queer. They wouldn't have called it then, but it was the kind of place that there's lots and lots of out there about automats, but not so much about how gay men sort of took it over and said, we're not going to be flashy about it. We're not going to make a big scene about it. But if I'm on one side of the automat and I lock eyes with somebody, if I cruise somebody else on the other side of the restaurant, that's a gay experience in this otherwise straight environment. And there are a lot of examples of that, of other restaurants and other types of restaurants that gay people sort of made their own under the radar of anyone else who was there. To me, a gay restaurant is a restaurant where when I open the door, I look around and I see my people.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. Journalist Eric Piepenberg calls himself a diner gay, a Gen Xer who came of age in the 1980s and 90s, when meeting up often involved hash browns, not hashtags.
I have a whole chapter on diners because I think people underestimate the extent to which diners, usually because of hours and location, are gay restaurants. But you can be 13-year-old who's just come out of the closet and you can go to a gay restaurant. You can't do that at a gay bar. You could be a gay elder who doesn't want to go to the bars with the music and the expensive drinks, and they just want to sit there and with their other elder friends, and they know you there. They know how you like your food. And so I think one of the things that you'll find often in a lot of these places is that the whole community, in terms of age, in terms of interests and types, generally can go there and be welcome, which is something that you don't necessarily find at gay bars.
What you do find at many diners is an enduring gay trope, the sassy, foul-mouthed waitress with a heart of gold. At the Silver Grill in Atlanta for five decades, beginning in 1958, that waitress was Peggy Hubbard. Piepenberg says the waitress, who died in 2010, was a mother figure for her gay customers. Well, motherly in a Joan Crawford kind of way.
You know, the type. She had just like the bouffant, the thick eyeshadow, no nonsense. If it's busy, I don't have time for you. Just tell me what you want and I'll put your order in. But she was also very present at AIDS fundraisers. She was also very much, the gay guys were her boys, and she integrated them into her life, which wasn't always the case. I think there are a lot of waitresses who are just like, that's my job and I go home. But Peggy was so beloved by the gay community and by drag queens and people who worked there and ate there that she sort of became part of that world.
The Silver Grill, where she waited tables, was a legendary establishment, spawning a 1975 song, The Silver Grill Blues, by drag artist Diamond Lil.
So when he asked me my name, I said, you can call me Lil. And furthermore, sweet baby, you can always find me hanging around this old Silver Grill.
And a 1997 country music show called Della's Diner 6, written by Tom Edwards, described by critics as Mayberry meets Melrose Place. Sadly, the Silver Grill closed in 2006. Another gay restaurant that obtained legendary status is still going strong. The servers are just as sassy as Peggy Hubbard, with a difference.
Lucky Chang's was a restaurant that opened in the early 90s in East Village in New York. And in the it sort of set itself apart because the servers and the people who worked there were all, in the first year, for sure, were all Asian drag queens and Asian trans women who worked in a drag context. And that had kind of never really been done exactly quite like that before. It got very popular very fast, and it made an appearance on Sex and the City, and celebrities would go there, rich Wall Street guys. It was the hot downtown hotspot to be.
After crisscrossing the country on a quest to document the history and current state of dining in the LGBTQ community, what did Piepenberg learn? Is the gay restaurant scene fading, or is it still a foundational experience in queer life?
I think the state of LGBTQ dining is really, really strong, and I think it is more diverse than ever. Does it look like what I remember back in the 90s? Mostly no, but it's so much broader and so much different, and I think so much more queer. I think that's the thing that sort of surprised me the most, is that restaurants that are queer are the food has queerness in them. The people who work there are trans and non-binary and just much more open about what it means to be a, a, LGBTQ and sort of define sexuality and gender in ways that I think have never really been done before.
Researching and writing Dining Out was a profound experience for Piepenberg, an opportunity to celebrate the people and places that shaped the LGBTQ movement and his own personal journey as a gay man.
I'm 54, and when I think of nostalgia, I think of, oh, what it was like to be in my 20s and go to these restaurants and, you know, flirt and listen to music and maybe, you know, meet someone in the bathroom, or, you know, just the things that you take for granted when you're in your 20s. And I think if I was in therapy, my therapist would probably say that I'm looking back on my life now and sort of understanding what it was like to be at a time when gay restaurants were thriving, now that they're really not, at least in New York, in the way that I remember them. And so I think I've learned about how fun it is that gay restaurants are sort of how they have evolved and changed. But also I have a new respect for the gay restaurants that were open way before I was even alive, and the ways that which gay people have for decades found each other through meals.
There's more, a lot more, in Eric Piepenberg's new book, Dining Out. If you have a favorite gay restaurant, past or present, you may just find it among the book's 300 or so pages. Are you a fan of Casita del Campo in Los Angeles? Do you remember The Florent, an all-night diner in Manhattan's meatpacking district? Are you a regular at Lazy's Kitchen in Salt Lake City? Wherever you do your LGBTQ dining, fine or otherwise, you're part of a great gay tradition. As Piepenberg writes, recounting a youthful experience at the Melrose in Chicago, a bad date, a satisfying meal, the promise of sex. That's what happens, or used to happen, at gay restaurants. I'd like to thank Eric Piepenberg for talking with me for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Marcos Najera and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. You heard music from Mrs. Doubtfire the Musical, Simon and Garfunkel, from the musical Oliver, and by Avis and Diamond Lil. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Trappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KZAX, Bellingham, Washington, 2RRR, Gladesville, New South Wales, WRFZ, Rochester, New York, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.